From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, convincing skeptics to believe. Here's what's happening. A type of black fungi that eats radiation has been discovered inside the Chernobyl nuke reactor. Back in 1991, the strange fungi was found growing up the walls of the reactor, which baffled scientists due to the extreme radiation-heavy environment. The researchers eventually realized that not only was the fungi impervious to the deadly radiation, it seemed to be attracted to it. And a decade later, researchers tested some of it and determined that it had a large amount of the pigment melanin, which is also found, among other places, in the skin of humans. This thing loves to eat radiation. And that's kind of intriguing, isn't it? A Massachusetts man attempting to save his neighbor from a dog attack accidentally shot and killed the neighbor with a crossbow. My gosh. The doctor in China, who was detained for warning others about the coronavirus before contracting that illness himself, has now died, according to the hospital treating him. Earlier on Thursday, there had been conflicting reports about his death, and the Wuhan Central Hospital said in a social media post just after midnight that he was in critical condition. Later, an updated post announced that he had died. Now, when American honeymooners and then newlyweds Milana Basso and Gaetano Cirillo set out for their great honeymoon, should have been the trip of a lifetime, right? Turned out to be a nightmare. As the Wuhan coronavirus spread around the world, sickening more than 28,000 people, killing more than 560, the couple has now found themselves quarantined on the Diamond Princess cruise ship off Japan for at least 2 weeks. More than 7,300 people are being held on two cruise ships off of Hong Kong and Japan amid concerns that those on board have been exposed to the virus. The Diamond Princess is anchored at Yokohama near Tokyo, carrying 2,666 passengers, including 428 Americans and 1,000 crew members. Captain Kelly Sweeney, the Master Mariner, on the line with us here. He knows all about ships. This has got to be a nightmare for these people, Kelly.
Ahoy, George. Yes, it certainly is a nightmare. And we're talking about a situation with ships and the coronavirus that we are wide open to be hit by this plague in the United States. Because since the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan rescinded the rules for health screening of ships, our government has not conducted any regular health screenings on vessels that enter our waters from foreign ports. Now, in 2013, in my column, Professional Mariner Magazine, I called for reinstituting these health screenings. So far, our government hasn't done anything. And in my opinion, George, if they don't get off the, and get on things and get rolling on this deal, this is going to turn into a pandemic. And ships are one of the best ways to transmit plagues anywhere in the world. This is no different.
That's all we need. Kelly, thanks. Those poor people stuck out there for at least 14 days, maybe even longer. But why the hysteria about the coronavirus? Because as I've been reporting, the normal flu kills anywhere between 10,000 and 61,000 Americans every year, just in this country. Let's check in with resident psychiatrist Dr. Peter Breggin. Peter, why is everybody seem to be so hysterical about this?
Well, I agree with you, George, that I don't think we're at the point where we should be hysterical yet, and probably at no point will we be. I think a lot of the fear centers around the fact that China is so closed and we really don't know a lot about what's going on
there.
That's
a good point.
I think a lot of it comes out of politics. But then people attach their fears to whatever is new, strange, scary. And it doesn't depend on the numbers, as you pointed out. I mean, even if we had a really bad time here with the coronavirus, it probably wouldn't even approximate deaths from the flu, you know, which can be in the tens of thousands.
Exactly. And if the coronavirus had the same mortality rate as the flu, if it had 60,000 dead Americans in a year, we'd be going crazy.
Yeah, that's right. So, and I think it's so important for you to point that out. Same thing happens with terrorism. The number of deaths we're likely to have in the country from terrorism or even mass shootings in the schools. This has a profound effect on people. Our school children are very, very frightened about mass shootings when the numbers are relatively small to the other threats they face, like crossing the street on their way home, which is going to be a huge and greater threat as long as they're in school. I think it's part of human nature, and I think it's just important to reassure people that what gets in the news and what's getting a lot of attention paid to them is not nearly going to approach the normal risks that we deal with on a daily basis. It's a good point, George.
All right. Thanks, Peter. I always love your input, too. The coronavirus outbreak will be worse for the global economy than the 2003 SARS epidemic was. But why? Let's check in with registered investment advisor Michael Mish Shedlock. Mish, you've been writing a lot about this virus, but why does it affect the markets and everything? You know, the casinos in Macau are shutting down. It's a mess.
I don't think we should downplay what's going on there. 60 million people, at least, in China are locked up. The problem, and the previous person on alluded to this, is we really don't have a lot of facts. So we can compare this to the flu virus, but how many people are really dying? Fortunately, it's contained in China, but what we know from China is some of the crematoriums are running 24 hours a day. This count of 500 is not believable. Meanwhile, let's get on to what we do know. We have floating quarantines now. We have ships that cannot get into Chinese ports. The Hyundai factory in Korea is shut down because it cannot get parts from Japan. We have ships that just, they're like floating quarantine zones.
It's horrible.
And we have air traffic between the U.S. and the U.K. and China that suspended DHL, all the delivery companies are saying the same thing. The question is, how long is this going to go on? And meanwhile, the death toll keeps going up and up and up. We are already at the point where I think it's going to affect Chinese GDP a percent, maybe 2%.
That's huge.
Even more, George? And let's compare this, one more comparison to SARS. In 2003, when SARS hit, the Chinese GDP was only about 3, 4, 5% maybe of global GDP. We're now talking close to 30, you know. That's the difference here. So this is a very, very big deal. And, George, you know, I'm hoping this thing comes to an end. They're working on some vaccines. The problem is those are going to take a year to get out. I don't know how bad it gets, George, before this is fixed.
And let me ask you something. If you were a conspiracy buff, what do you think of the possibilities that some kind of disease was popped down on China?
There's a lot of that discussion, and I tend to stay away from that, George, and I'm glad you asked that. I tend to stay away from these things, and we're seeing it. One of my friends was actually banned from Twitter, Zero Hedge, people might know that name, for, you know, just actually posting, you know, the fact that someone said this. So now, you know, we've got, I think, you know, people ought to be able to speak up. I mean, they can't spread false news. All he said was he was reporting on someone else doing it. We're now at the point where, you know, you have to be fearful of what you even say. I do know that my blog is banned in China. And all we're trying to do is get to the facts. But when China comes out and is now cracking down on people making claims. And unfortunately, look back to this doctor. That was the first story when I came on at the top of the hour.
He's dead.
This doctor is now dead. He tried to help these people. He warned about this back in December, and China stifled this guy. They sanctioned him. They told him to shut up. And he was right all along.
Look what happened. Mish, watch this story for us on a global level, if you would. Want to live longer? Try being a social butterfly. A new study points out that the perks of rubbing elbows with a wide variety of people, especially in our later years, could be a key to a happier, longer, healthier life. So have some fun. Elon Musk wants, listen to this, wants to connect your brain to a computer this year as his company Neuralink Mind Chips are prepared to launch. That's right. He has tweeted that his brain computer chip company, Neuralink, is working on an awesome version of this device. The billionaire believes his brain interface technology will turn humans into a genius super race. Musk has been developing the technology called Neuralink because he thinks humans must become one with machines in order to survive being replaced by artificial intelligence. His plan to save the human race involves wiring computer chips into our minds to merge us with artificial intelligence. Isn't that amazing? I happen to know that our board op, Michael, plans to get little lasers in his head with chips in order to increase his brain power and make him even more of a genius. You never know what's going to happen. Next up, The Art of War on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. The Art of War is an ancient Chinese military application dating right around the 5th century B.C. The work, which is attributed to the ancient Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu, is composed of 13 chapters. Each one is devoted to an aspect of warfare and how it applies to military strategy and tactics. But can the same thing be used for us to increase our lifestyle and make our lives better? With us is Gary Gagliardi. He's back with us, last on with us about 12 years ago, became well known for using the principles of Sun Tzu's The Art of War, as the founder and CEO of an Inc. 500 software company. And with his company and after selling it, he worked for decades with the world's largest organizations teaching the ancient classics strategy. Based on this work, he authored a new award-winning English translation of The Art of War, and over three dozen other books adapting the strategic approach to different ideas of modern competition, and started a strategy training organization. Gary, welcome back. 12 years has been way too long.
It's been a long time. Yeah, nice to have, and thanks for having me, George. And just want to say hello to all your dedicated listeners out there.
Thank you.
Great audience.
And we're going to have some fun with phone calls with them next hour. They just think the world of your work. How did you get involved in selecting Sun Tzu's work as the basis for what you've been doing?
Well, I didn't get involved with it. It got involved with me. I was an aimless college dropout. I was working in sales because I had no other skills. And I wasn't doing well. I'd been fired from 5 jobs in 5 years. And my sister gave me a copy of this book. And I can't say I really understood at the time, but I started seeing how some of the ideas in that book really, you know, were the same thing as I was trying to do in sales. And After that, I got better at what I did, and I started succeeding and started getting promoted. And I can't say I really understood the book until I had my own company and started teaching it to my sales guys. And after that, I got into it more deeply, and we built our software company around its principles of adapting to reality. And we became known for that, and they wrote articles about our use of Sun Tzu, and I began talking to large companies about it. And when I sold my company and was financially independent, I could do anything I wanted. These companies were inviting me all over the world to teach their employees and their customers about these ideas, and so I did that for the next 15, 20 years.
Good for you. Sun Tzu must have been a genius. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he lived in a time in China that was called the Warring States period. And China at that time was divided up into, well, there were 5 to 8 major states, but dozens of other warring principalities. And Sun Tzu was the member of a class of, they were traditional mercenaries. They were called landless nobility, the Qi. And they basically sold their talents to the various kingdoms, you know, that were fighting with one another. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, early Europe where there were all city-states, really, you know, the Greco-Roman era, really the Greco area, when there were city-states fighting amongst each other. And Sun Tzu, came from this, you know, martial tradition, and he wrote down these ideas that were probably, you know, family traditions passed down from generation to generation. And he wrote them all down, and he used it kind of as an interview or to get a job with a kingdom called Wu, which was kind of a semi-barbaric kingdom. It was on the long side of the Yalu River. But because of Sun Tzu and his teachings, it became the dominant force during the next 60 years or so. And after that, the teachings spread through the various states of China and led to the unification of China under the Emperor of Qin, which was the principality that ended up winning the Warring States period, and the periods of the emperor began.
Gary, what were some of his techniques? What were some of the things that he pointed out in his works?
Well, the big thing about Sun Tzu is that it's not a work about war, and we misunderstand it because it's written in terms of war and it's translated in terms of war.
Right.
But in reading Sun Tzu, you won't know anything about how, you know, wars were fought in 5th century BC China. You won't know if they used, you know, billy clubs or machine guns to fight one another, because it doesn't talk about that. It's not like reading, you know, modern strategists where they talk about how to use cannons or how to use, well, even in ancient Japan, you know, Mitsumoto's book is about the use of the short sword and the long sword. What Sun Tzu wrote about was the one weapon in competition that never changes, and that's the human mind and how the human mind works and what goes on when people are competing with each other. And that's why it works so well for everybody. You know, all you people out there in the world, you're living in a more competitive world, and you have to deal with the same kinds of challenges and the same kinds of issues that generals in ancient China had to deal with, and you have to make decisions every day. And Sun Tzu's methods teach you that it's not about fighting each other for position, but it's about understanding what a position is and how you advance it over time.
We should be using that right now in this country, and we're not, are we?
Well, a lot of people are, actually.
I mean, in terms of government.
Politicians, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and politicians have always been the negative example of what not to do.
Exactly.
And it's kind of amazing, because they are competitive. They're competing with each other in elections, and, you know, they have to win elections. But for some reason, we choose to. One of Sun Tzu's rules is you don't trust what people say. You watch and see what they do. You can really figure out what people are about by what they do. And instead, when we don't pay any attention to what politicians actually do. We just listen to what they say, and the two things aren't the same. And part of the problem, I think, is our media in this country is, you know, such a great amplifier for what people say, is that we hear a lot of words and we form opinions by words and images, and nobody really gets beneath the surface to see what's really happening, at least not over the short term. I think over the long term, people say, well, things are getting worse or things are getting better, and you know, they make some good judgments, but still half the politicians out there, you know, aren't doing anything for people on a day-to-day basis. And you know, it's just poor competition. They aren't being judged by what they actually do. You know, it's like if we judged basketball games or football games by how you know, much trash talking the participants did, you know, we'd end
right.
up with pretty bad teams. You know, you have to judge them by what they do on the field, and that's what we're not doing.
Wasn't his work banned in China for a couple thousand years?
Yeah, it was actually very popular. It was supposedly the first emperor of China burned all the books except for five books, and one of them was Sun Tzu's The Art of War. And for the first 500 years, it spread through China, and it actually became the basis for what we know of as martial arts today. But, you know, what happened after that time is that bureaucracy rose up around the emperor, and bureaucracies hate change. And Sun Tzu's book is about how people change their lives. And the bureaucracies want everybody to keep in their place so that those bureaucracies can keep their place, you know, over everybody. And Sun Tzu's book is basically a very revolutionary tract, because it teaches people how to continually improve their position. And, you know, bureaucracies didn't want that, so the Chinese banned it. The bureaucracies today feel the same way, though. Bureaucrats
That's
in
right.
every era and every place are the same. They want people to stay in their place. And what Sun Tzu's work teaches is how do you improve your position. And when a lot of people are acting that way, you get a more dynamic society. And, you know, bureaucracies are threatened by dynamic societies. They want to feel like everything is in their control, that they have, you know, their hand and into everything. And the only things that happen are things that they allow to happen.
Gary, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more about this incredible work that you've done, your translations as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you with Gary Gagliardi, and his websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Gary, do you think successful generals like George Patton, for example, may have read The Art of War?
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it's taught in the United States military academies. And going all the way back to Napoleon, that was supposedly the first person that studied The Art of War.
Interesting.
In the West, that is.
The first
translation was a French translation brought back by the Jesuit missionaries.
That's back in the 1700s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, like 1700s, right. It was 17, whatever. Yeah, I can't remember exactly.
1772. I've done my homework for you, Gary.
Good job.
You have said that. Go ahead.
But the point is that it's not only about war. It's about how you manage human hierarchies. You know, the idea that Sun Tzu taught was that a good general doesn't fight 100 battles and win 100 battles. A good general finds a way to win without fighting a single battle. And the way you do that is develop positions where people don't want to fight you, and instead they want to join you. They want to support you.
That's a good point, too. You say that the English translations of the book, including your own, may be misleading. Tell me about that.
Well, a lot of the English translations, any translation done before 1970 is going to be incomplete. But, you know, the Sun Tzu's work was banned. It was passed down through the aristocratic families. There were 7 different versions. You know, the early English translations all came at the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the, the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. And they were all from fragmentary versions. The first complete version wasn't put together till 1970 in Taiwan, and there have only been a few translations of that version. Mine is one of them, but all of them are misleading just simply because they're done in the context of war, and people read them that way. The book is really not about fighting. It's about the human psychology that helps us understand our competitive position and how to advance it. You know, we read these translations, and I'll tell you, I did it myself when I first read it, and I read it as fighting, and I read it as battling, and I read it as, you know, the kind of, you know, stuff you have to do to take somebody else's position. But what the book really teaches is how to develop positions of your own where you don't have to fight people, where you move into openings where people not only let you move up in the hierarchy, but they actually help you and support you in moving up. And that's what Sun Tzu's book taught. He taught that, you know, if an actual battle where people are killed takes place, well, there's a mistake that's been made.
That's a good point.
Both generals thought they could win, and at least one of them is wrong, and probably both of them are wrong, because they're both going to suffer more than they need to by choosing to fight one another.
His idea of winning was cooperation, wasn't it?
Exactly. People think that competition is the opposite of cooperation, but in reality, competition is required to create competition, because you can't compete with everybody. You have to choose who you're going to cooperate with and how, and that means that you have competing alternatives. And anytime there's a choice to be made, that's when competition takes place. Competition is really making a choice. And, you know, it's true in sports, you work those choices out by people playing on the field, but in human minds, who they choose to support has to be worked out in your head. You know, the army that wins is the army that has the most support from their people, from their country, from their soldiers, you know. And Sun Tzu taught that size wasn't strength. What is strength, great strength, is unity and focus. And that's, you know, what most people lack today is unity and focus. They aren't focused. And they, you know, a lot of people don't have any goals. And, you know, the workers really won about human psychology. And the fact that our competitive positions are what we're trying to maintain, and those positions only exist in human minds.
And you say his works basically can be used in personal relationships, parenting, all kinds of things. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I've done. Yeah, the It's funny because at first I was doing this only in business because that's where my reputation
sure.
was. And I had some success because I built an Inc. 500 company and was known for that. But then I got cancer and I went through treatment and all this stuff. And I saw that people, you know, were literally dying because they didn't know how to make good decisions. They didn't know how to weigh their alternatives. They didn't know how to get information. They didn't know how to position themselves to survive. And so I began to change my focus and began writing books about personal relationships. I, you know, had a terrible first marriage and a great second marriage. And so I learned about that. And in my second marriage, I was using Sun Tzu's ideas and about parenting and about, you know, helping kids, you know, manage through school and things like that. And, you know, I ended up writing a book called The Golden Key to Strategy that won the Ben Franklin Award as the best self-help psychology book of the year. And, you know, it was, you know, a very rewarding thing to go through something like cancer and realize that I could help other people other than just business people.
Is that why you've kind of disappeared over the last several years? Was it that?
Well, I really stopped doing my formal training about 5 years ago. And, you know, in the software business of my company, I've worked with, I have a short attention span. It lasts about 15 years. And, I did software for about 15 years. And when I made my money there, I could have obviously started other software.
Sure.
It was 1990s when I sold my company and I'd been very successful and I could have done more of that, but I had enough money that I wasn't worried about. I could do anything I wanted. And so I really love Sun Tzu. So I did that for about 15 years. And after, you know, my books, I've won a number of awards. I traveled the world. My books have been translated all over the world. I got to, you know, meet and work with, you know, the world's leading organizations and great people all over the world. You know, we had trainers at one point all over the world using my stuff. But after a while, you know, I'd been there and done that. It just, you know, it got to be too much like work. And I've always been a pretty lazy fellow. And, you know, I still want to help people. But as far as traveling around and doing all the work I was doing, promoting and stuff, I just didn't have the fire in the belly to do it. Everybody needs a mission, you know. In
sure,
life.
Absolutely.
And I think the big problem with most people is they don't have a mission. And, you know, the chemicals that keep track of our natural hierarchies, you know, the chemicals that you know, give us satisfaction really depend upon us having a mission, because when we get satisfaction is when we're moving toward our mission and moving toward our goals. You've got to be making progress to those goals. When you attain certain goals, and, you know, I did probably everything I could do in the world of software and then in the world of Sun Tzu, and I never had a goal to be a billionaire or anything. I just was interested in these ideas, and I didn't have any more goals there. So I wanted, you know, I wanted to get into something new. I always am looking for something new. And the Sun Tzu stuff, I'm still working on it. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a new translation, I think, you know, I understand it a lot more today than I did 20 years ago when I did my translation, 1999, not quite 20 years ago, but a little more than that. But I'll do a new translation of that at some point, but I'm not doing all the traveling work that I used to do.
How many times do you have to read the book, The Art of War, before you get it?
I don't think reading the book, unless you can read Chinese, is going to do it for you. I read probably 6 or 7 translations, and I was kind of confused because they were all different.
They're all different, exactly.
When I was working in business and trying to use these ideas in business, and I didn't really understand it until I started trying to teach other people these ideas. And it was really in teaching that I really kind of came closer to mastering them. But then I taught myself ancient Chinese and started studying the original work. And the original work is kind of magical. Ancient Chinese isn't a spoken language. It's like a conceptual language. It's like mathematical formulas. You know, reading Sun Tzu is more like reading Euclid than it is like reading a self-help book. And you know, the ideas are so deep that you can almost get lost in them. They're very deep ideas. And you know, what you find out over time is that these ideas are connected to what we're just discovering today in modern science, you know, this idea of hierarchies and how these hierarchies work and how people interact. You know, that stuff was all in Sun Tzu 2,500 years ago. You know, there's new science today about the five aspects of personality. Well, Sun Tzu came very close to describing the same thing 2,500 years ago without the computers to figure it all out. So it's kind of an amazing work. You know, the fact is that when people have a mission, you know, Sun Tzu said there were five aspects that define a competitive position. You know, there's your mission, which is your goals. And you have to have a goal because the same chemicals that regulate our positive and negative moods are tied to making progress toward our goals. You also have to deal with the ground. The ground is what gives you rewards. Our ground that we compete in is human society, and it's other people that can reward us or fight against us or support us. Then you have the climate. Things are always changing. You were just talking about the newest epidemic, the coronavirus, mm-hmm. You know, and that's something that's changing. And the changes in the climate are unpredictable and uncontrollable. And there's also the things that create new opportunities and new threats that you have to protect yourself from. And then you have your personal capabilities, the skills that you've learned over time, and your basic personality, you know, what you're really like. And all those things create your competitive position. And that position is being judged all the time by other people, and you're judging people all the time, and we all hate to be judged. You hate to be judged. I hate to be judged. But the fact is that's the nature of reality. We're all judging one another. And Sun Tzu's system is all about how we get people to judge us better. And we almost think about our position in competitive strategy. The best way to think about your position is that they're not really judging you. They're just judging what they see of your position. You know, they're judging the things that you're communicating about your position to them. And a lot of it's about, you know, what your mission is and, you know, what kind of character you have and stuff like that. And all that is controllable. I think of it like an avatar in a computer game. You know, you're trying to win the computer game and your avatar has certain skills, and you manage your competitive position like you manage an avatar in a computer game. Only you can do that in the real world, and you can advance in the real world continually, just like, you know, avatars can advance in computer games.
Does he predict things? Is he very prophetic?
Well, only in the sense that he says that things work a certain way. He actually has nine stages he describes that competitive situations go through. And, you know, how to define those situations and how to respond to them. But those situations tend to follow one after another, and they're too complicated to go into now. But his system does predict certain things, you know, like companies will grow large and then they'll die because of the accumulation of bureaucracies, things like that. He predicts that there's certain things, you know, people that fight all the time, you know, that they're going to expend too much of their resources on fighting all the time, and they're going to get weaker for it because we all have, you know, unlimited desires, but we only have limited resources, and you have to focus your limited resources on things that you really want and not use them in destructive ways, because when you push other people, they're going to push back, and you can expend all your resources doing that instead of improving your position.
So he really wasn't a champion of battles. He was a champion of talking your way out of it, basically.
Well, his system is one of positioning. In other words, you try and find positions, and you do this by looking for opportunities. And when an opportunity is an opening, what he called unoccupied ground, that others will rather support than oppose. And in social context, you know, in the context of our lives today, it means openings are things, are needs that aren't being fulfilled by others. And if you can find a need and fill it with the skills you have, you know, others will support you, and they won't fight you. If you try and go after, for example, your boss's position, well, you're going to get all kinds of opposition, run into all kinds of company politics and stuff like that. But if you go to your boss, and instead of, you know, like most people go to their boss and they bring them problems. Oh, I need more money. That's a problem. Or this guy's doing this. That's a problem.
Bring them solutions.
Yeah, right. bring a solution. Even better than bringing a solution is find out what he's looking for, what his goals are, and help him with what he's trying to do instead of what you're trying to do. Focus on what the people that can improve your life are looking for and what's changing around them, you know, they're having problems dealing with. And, you know, use your ability to satisfy those things. I mean, I got into computers. I was in consumer product sales, but, you know, computers came in and, you know, salespeople, sales managers had to deal with computer reports and stuff. And I'd learned a little bit about computers in color. So I began helping my boss with their computer reports and stuff like that, understanding them and understanding how they played a role in sales and stuff like that. And, you know, eventually, you know, that got me promoted in my job. It got me better sales territories. But eventually I ended up in computers and, you know, learning about working in the computer industry and starting my own software company.
And that made a world of difference, changed your life.
Yeah, it did that. It was a great experience, great time. And also I saw that was an opening. Once more, change is what creates opportunities. That was, climate is one of the five characteristics of a position. And that new computer technology was just coming out. This is the microcomputer revolution when the PC was introduced and all that stuff. And there was a lot of openings there. There was a lot of things that needed to be done. And, you know, I was able to start a company that addressed one of those issues. And, you know, there were lots of companies that did the same thing. But, you know, I wasn't trying to be the next, you know, I came from consumer products. I wasn't trying to be the next Procter & Gamble. I was going into a new area where the companies were just being invented.
By reading The Art of War, at what point did you get it and really understand it?
Well, I'm still getting things all the time. I mean, I was just reading it today, the section on deception, and thinking through, you know, as I've gotten older, I've realized, as you get older, you do learn some things, strangely enough.
And one of the things
I've learned is that, you know, deception doesn't work over time. You know, it always fails. You know, everybody gets, you know, nobody gets away with anything in life, ever.
It always comes back to haunt them. Hold on for a second, Gary. Already at the top of the hour, we're going to come back. We'll talk more about your work, and also we'll take phone calls. It's fascinating. The Art of War by Sun Tzu. It's not about conflict. It's about the other thing. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.